The purpose is to discuss what Kepler can tell us about planet formation. And what are the key data? Now, we can argue about what's the most important stuff, but I think I've been listing things as things that were either surprises or big question marks before. And Kepler found that it's common for stars to have planets larger than Earth that are not giant planets within 100 days. And it's not the majority of stars having them. It's of order 10 or 20% of the stars have one or more.
All right, just so you have the context of a geochemist, right? So I don't do this stuff. But what I have learned over the couple of weeks that I've been here is I don't understand your application of statistics in the sense of, are there biases in that last statement associated with methods used?
Yes, I should really say that stars that are roughly solar mass. So if you're saying that most stars are M stars, the statistics are somewhat different. And M stars, the cooler M stars especially, there aren't very good statistics.
Yeah, but the 100 days isn't because you just measure on the order 100 days.
That's all we, yeah. No, this is a statement. It's not saying that they're uncommon beyond 100 days. It's saying that the statement says that there are a lot of stars. 10, 20% of these stars have these systems of one or more of these planets, and the solar system does not have any.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that these are the most common.
Oh, no, no. No statement, no implication, no intention of saying that. Rocky planets larger than about 60% larger than Earth are uncommon. And that's, if you want to parse that statement in more detail, it's really uncommon with orbital periods of less than 10 to 20 days. Because beyond that, although we'd find rocky planets, we have very few mass measurements. But they're not, like, out to 100 days, you're not having a lot of two Earth radii rocky planets because they're so massive that they'd be showing up in TTVs of other planets. Unless they only existed in planets that in systems where there's only one planet in a coplanar orbit in that region.
So why do you reject such an hypothesis that they are to write itself? That if it's all based on TTV?
Well, close in, it's not based on TTV. It's based on RV.
Right.
And then the typical densities of these planets that are not giants, larger than 1.6 our Earth, drops with increasing size. But there's a large scatter in M for a given mass, for a given radius. And there's an immense scatter in radius, or really volume, for a given mass. And there's one thing that is implicit in this slide, and it's a term that I've been using twice, ungiant planets. And I'm using it to emphasize that there is no sign of a line between rocky planets and planets that have gaseous envelopes. And gaseous envelopes are the planets of several Earth radii, and only a few Earth masses have to have most of their volume occupied by gases. You have intermediate density planets between this Earth stuff and the very low densities, and they could be water or half water, half rocky, but there's no evidence for it. It's not like there are a lot of planets which fit the water, and then beyond a reasonable water composition, you have just a few of these gas-rich planets. The reason I use the term ungiants is there does seem to be a line or a fuzzy line between these smaller planets and the giant planets. There aren't a lot of planets that are tens of Earth masses. If you look in terms of how common planets are, in general, smaller is more, but it's not a uniform distribution. And it really seems that once you get over this hump of 20, 30, 40 Earth masses, then it gets easier to accrete. Most planets don't make it over that hump. And this, really, we didn't know of planets like this. There were Uranus, Neptune, but a lot of these planets are significantly lower in density than Uranus and Neptune. And in a few cases where they are very low mass and very large, the envelope, which occupies the volume, is a trivial amount of mass, especially if it's, assuming it's hydrogen and helium, or it's actually small enough in mass that it's not inconceivable that it could be a hydrogen envelope that didn't accrete as gravitationally with helium, but came from dissolution of ices. On the other hand, there's no way you're going to get this much hydrogen from that. So there are many areas of the diagram, like here and here, where you don't need gravitational accretion by these small bodies. But there are regions. Questions?
Just what the scale on the right.
Oh, sorry. This is the amount of flux the planets are subjected to. So it's like an equilibrium temperature. But an equilibrium temperature, you're assuming an albedo. So Earth is at the kind of violet end of the scale, and this is up to around 10,000 times Earth. And then Uranus and Neptune are just black. Fit at all on that scale.
The sense of color is opposite to usual temperature, right?
Yes. It is opposite of the physics temperatures, but it is like a lot of the artistic temperatures. Blue feels cold, right? But this is, most of these planets are Kepler planets. And many of them have TTV masses. The ones with the higher fluxes tend to have RV. And the biases are still being quantified here. There's clearly a huge diversity. This plot is being populated far more. There's not one nice little curve. And this was just not expected, not predicted.
So you mentioned that most planets didn't get a chance to grow above, I don't know, 10 something Earth masses or so. I mean, I know it's where the old-fashioned story for the solar system giant planets was once they got so big, then you had their atmospheres could collapse and they could accrete a lot more gas. How does that argument affected when you scale it into 0.1 AU? What is, if you just took this simple old-fashioned theory and repeated it, what would we predict the critical core mass for gravitational collapse would have been?
Okay.
did you mean gravitational collapse or core accretion model?
How big of a core would you need to accrete before the atmosphere could collapse from the disk?
Right. I don't see a collapse, because collapse is used for people without growth without a core. So let's just avoid that term.
You don't have a hydrodynamic collapse. That was from the old models back in the early 80s, I think. It's quasi-static collapse. But you get much faster accretion. It's not hugely sensitive to distance from the star, because as your temperature goes up, your pressure also goes up.
Yeah, it's only logarithmically sensitive. The accretion time matters. If you try and build the planet very quickly, then it's harder to get an envelope.
Right. But if you build it quickly, you build the core quickly, and then you have the gas around for a while, then it's easier.
Then you're in business. Then you can build it.
Because it's...
You have to wait.
Right. It's a competition. More core is better. But so a bigger mass of the core is better, but a smaller m dot of the core, because you have that energy coming in, is puffing up the envelope.
You have core 7? So the names are only Kepler ones.
The names are only Kepler ones, and in fact, most of the ones that are not named are Kepler ones too. But we do have some of the others. What this plot does, I think, is it did not include things that this actually is probably corrosive.
I'm pretty sure that's corrosive.
Yeah, because this is the... I don't think that's a Kepler planet. And this is a few months old. Mm-hmm. And Eric Lopez produced this plot. And these are the ones that are in his list. And there's some advantage to having been discovered earlier to be on the list. It wasn't just a snapshot. And it's tricky because you have all sorts of points with all sorts of different uncertainties.
You know, that dot right there, not that we care, but that one, I'm pretty sure it's Kepler 78.
Right.
Right?
78b.
Yeah, and it's not labeled. So that means there are many of these that aren't labeled.
Most of the ones are Kepler ones. In fact, the ones that are solid circles are Kepler ones. Mm.
That makes sense.
Yes. And this was actually produced for an article, and the planets that were labeled are the named ones, and so that is indeed Corozza. The one rocky that is not a one rocky exoplanet. There's information on the planets themselves, and there's a second set of information, and that's on planetary systems.
Packed,
flat systems are common. By which I mean, if we were looking in the plane, and just the planets that we see in the plane, close enough to the plane that they're all transiting, are very close to one another, so close that there can't be things in between them. They wouldn't be stable. And actually, what first attracted me to Kepler 11 was how packed it was. And if we go back and see some of those planets, they're quite low density. If you try and go from Earth and Venus to Uranus and Neptune, they're all above that interpolation curve. And as it is, they're perturbing each other substantially enough that their orbital periods from one period to the next, these have periods, the inner five planets are between 10 and 50 days, period. The innermost one is a little smaller than twice Earth's radius. Everything else is about 2.5 Earth radii to almost 5 Earth radii. They're perturbing one another such that their orbital periods change by 5 to 10 minutes from period to period, from orbit to orbit. And these transit timing variations have been used to get the masses. And the masses are smaller than this interpolated curve. I was wondering, it just not knowing any of this back 5 years ago, how you could have such big planets so close to one another. And the answer is twofold. One is that the planets are not as massive as we would have guessed previously, which means that they have significant envelopes of light material. In the case of most of them, that's got to be hydrogen helium. In principle, for most of them, it could be pure helium, but there's just no way you can do that. And for a few of them, like maybe over here, very low mass ones, in principle, you could have it with pure H2. But then you have bigger ones like E and D, which have enough mass, especially with E, that you couldn't get the ice to bring in that H2. So the only way you could think of it forming is by just gravitational accretion. And these are low mass planets that are close to their star, have accreted a substantial amount gravitationally of hydrogen and helium. We don't have anything at all like this in our solar system.
So far you're stuck pretty much to the data, but what's your personal interpretation of why we have so many close-packed systems?
Why we have so many close-packed
systems? Yeah, what do you think?
Where are they from? Mm-hmm.
Sure. Can you go back to this statement that you showed? Right. Do you really mean that most flat systems are packed? Is that what you mean?
You don't know that.
That's not what you said.
Doesn't say that.
But I wonder.
But there are many of Kepler's multis, it's not unusual for a multi to be fairly closely packed in the sense that it's difficult to have planets in between any of the gaps in planets. The model suggests that at least about half of the planets that we see in this category of planets where we have good statistics are planets are in systems with more than one of these planets. They're not, in terms of the actual numbers we see, that's not true, but we have geometrical restrictions. So it's not unusual for them to be common, which means that they've got to be, it's not like they're 5% of the systems. It's tens of percent, but you have, whether most systems are packed or whether a majority is not packed, but there's a substantial minority that is packed. That's a trickier question. But these have to be these packed systems. They're flat, and since they're packed, and in most cases, we don't really have orbits. We just have periods. When I'm saying they're packed means I'm using the masses typical for their sizes, and they can't be substantially eccentric. Because if they were, then it wouldn't be stable.
If you took the terrestrial planets in the solar system and scaled them down so that they could all transit so close in, would that count as a packed planet system?
The solar system is pretty close to being packed, yeah. It's kind of at the borderline of being packed. Some of these are a lot more packed than
the solar system. And he means as it is with its current scale.
Now, if you just had the terrestrial planets at its current scale, without the giant planets, then you'd have more room. Because the giant planets on long time scales perturb the terrestrial planets significantly.
I think I'm having difficulties between packed and unpacked.
Okay.
But the last statement you made helped. That is the role that the giant planets play in our system.
Yeah, they excite things.
So your definition of packing is also one that includes mass distribution.
Yes. It's whether you could put planets in between that aren't there.
So, Jack, would you say then that the planets, the terrestrial planets that we do have in the solar system, are basically the only ones that could still? That are in the stable islands of stability that could survive?
Yes. Yes. You could not have more terrestrial planets between the orbits of Mercury and Mars.
But you could have moved them around to different places, right?
You could have moved them around. You could put more terrestrial planets in that amount of space if you designed it that way.
But with the current setup, you can't. Yeah.
Right. Right. You can't add something to the current setup. And that's an issue with packing, because you could get them much closer than they are, but only under these kind of, it would be difficult to understand how they formed that way.
So look at the implications for the frequency of giant planets around the packed systems. Based on stability arguments?
Not a lot of implications, because certainly not a lot of system implications for giant planets where they are in our solar system, because the giant planets.
Well, but everyone can take giant planets at 0.5 AU.
Right. Giant planets at 0.5 AU, but Jeff can tell you how many giant planets there are at 0.5 AU.
But he doesn't necessarily know how often they are in packed systems with little planets close in.
Right.
And so,
right.
So here what you could do is try to tie these together and ask the question, are these uncorrelated events, whether you have tight small planets and giant planets that have to one of you, or do they avoid each other? Or maybe they go together, I guess.
There are other things about giant planets out there. And if there, if you have one giant planet on a circular orbit, it's not doing much. If it has a substantial eccentric orbit, as do a lot of giant planets that have their 1-2 AU, then it does a lot more. Our solar system, the reason the giant planets are doing it is because of secular resonances, where the precession that they exert in each other's orbit alignment matches the precession of the locations in the inner solar system. And that's a lot of the coupling between the giant planets and terrestrial planets is with these secular resonances, and it's because you have both Jupiter and Saturn out there.
So is the implication of that one possible interpretation of that is that it's pointless to try to study this observationally, because if we can't know about the eighth giant planet and how it shifts the secular resonances, we can't really work out the implications,
I think it's, well, some of it in terms of observation, in terms of getting the detailed dynamics, it's very difficult to do detailed dynamics, but it means that you really want to do statistical models, and you want to see whether, if you look at the stars which have these packed systems inside, tend to have giant planets or don't tend to have giant planets. But so I would say that statistics, it's very, very difficult to have the quality of the data to do detailed dynamical models.
I can name the ones.
The system that is the best one for doing dynamical models that we have the best data on is the first system, Wolschen system, pulsars. Beautiful as all that Jeff and Kepler have done. Now, it's not at that level, but you don't have many. Those systems are uncommon. You don't have many of these old pulsars that have been sped up. And most of them don't have planets.
So let me make one suggestion. We have 15 minutes left. Let's get Jack through the majority of his slides. Let him get them through maybe mostly uninterrupted.
Okay.
And then through the last 3 or 4 minutes for more of our usual questions.
Okay. Well, I don't have much more because I was told I was going to be interrupted all the time. Most planets are not in or near mean Roshan resonances where they have a period ratio like 2-1 or 3-2. And this is a bit surprising because these planets are close in, and if you have convergent migration, then the energetics of it pushes you into a resonance, and the planets will move in lockstep. That lockstep with the outer planet moving in, as most of my migration models suggest, is from a dynamical standpoint very similar to the inner one moving out, as Stan Peale realized back in 1979 before Voyager went by, pushing these moons together. Peter Goldreich talked about how this could get the planets to be locked in resonance. Stan Peale took it a step further and predicted that the continued pushing would excite eccentricities. It's a free energy that you get from these interactions, and those would be then damped, causing the volcanoes on Io. But why aren't they in resonances if they migrated? Maybe they didn't migrate, but then they have to be formed in situ, and there's, in most models of protoplanetary disk, you don't have that much material, at least most old models. Nonetheless, it's not a random distribution. There are resonance planets, systems of multiple resonances. And these are precise enough multiple resonances that you wouldn't get this by chance. So they're anomalous, but they're not super anomalous. They're there. So I think these are the main clues that Kepler has given us to planet formation. And that's really the gist of my talk and gist of my presentation to engender discussion, which it's been doing. But if you're asking what the bottom line is, there are bottom lines. Remember, I said some of these planets are low enough mass for their sizes that they've got to have accreted hydrogen and helium gravitationally. And they're low mass accreted gravitationally. They're common. So either there was a lot of migration, or the mass of these disks were much larger than models for the solar system, minimum mass models for the solar system.
And tying back to what Hilke's argument was earlier, just multiplying the gas and the solids by a big factor creates issues, because then you would expect them to be giant planets, because they would be gravitationally unstable. So you need to really enhance the solids without enhancing the gas, enhance the solids by more than the gas if you want to be able to make them merely in situ and keep them small.
Gravitationally unstable?
So the Q, if you dial up this mass of the disk by factor 100, her argument was the Q of the disk would lead to toward violent instabilities, and presumably you'd get gas giants. Since we're trying to keep them smaller than that, we need to get them to be able to get that big at their core, but not accrete the gas.
I'm not sure it would make gas giants, but if you have very unstable disks, they're not going to be around very long.
Sure. There's the migration issue, but so to build on your point, you would need very massive disks which are enriched in solids relative to gas.
Mm-hmm. Maybe one discussion point that I don't think I've heard much in the last 3 weeks, might be nice to get your take, Jack, and everybody else's, is this issue of the surface mass density of the protoplanetary disks at the time that planets might actually form. And I guess, to start the discussion, I think most people in this room realize there are absolutely no measurements at all of the densities or the temperature of either the gas or the dust in the inner 5 AUs around young stars. And there are and the only measurements we do have are of densities and temperatures of the disk 100 AUs from the star or farther, where there's millimeter radiation and some gas diagnostics and so on. So point number one, I guess, is when you point out, and it's been pointed out by many people, that we don't, that we have a minimum mass only nebula, and one wonders what the densities might actually be in the inner few AUs. I'd say there's no observational constraints. Two points come to mind. Peter Goldreich once sort of wagged his forefinger at me, and Goldreich said, Jeff, most of the mass of the host star comes from a disk. So something of order a solar mass worth of material went through the disk. And we shouldn't forget that that means that on the order of 10 to the 5 years, you know, something like a solar mass worth of material, that's way less than the mass that we normally assign. Sorry, that's way more than the mass that we normally assign to the minimum mass solar nebula. So I think there is an open question, which is, you know, given our lack of empirical knowledge, but a sense of how the star itself formed, is it plausible that disks had something like 3 to 10 times higher mass densities than we normally ascribe to the minimum mass solar nebula?
Well, the other issue is the minimum mass is a minimum of the mass that has been processed through the disk, actually. Because you could have the material come in, drop the solids, and you could never be. You could actually have a nebula in principle that never got as massive as a minimum mass nebula.
Or the opposite.
Right.
Which is you make planets and they all go into the star. Yes.
And you would also have the issue, while most of the mass does get processed through the disk, most of it doesn't get processed through the disk very far out.
Sorry. What do you mean by that?
That means you don't have most of the mass at 10 AU. You have it.
Most of the mass started at 1,000 AU and had to pass through
to get there. When it hit the disk.
Okay.
Yeah, the disk is set by the angular momentum budget. Yeah. And actually, we have some ideas about
it's like
that.
50,
I mean, we know why 40 AU is a reasonable number for our solar system. Just on the basis of angular momentum budget, what comes to stuff, and also, although it's not dominant, just the vorticity of the Milky Way.
You just collapse the cloud, but and you have disks. Common to see disks out 100 AU, whatever, and for bigger stars, bigger disks, but.
Yeah, although presumably with most, I mean, it's not clear. When astronomers are looking at disks that are 100 AU or 1,000 AU even, they don't have a sense of how the mass is distributed.
Right. Yes.
Correct. I wonder if we're suffering. Oh, I'll just say one last thing, Lauren. I mean, I wonder if we're suffering from the usual anthropocentric bias that we've grown up as children at the minimum mass solar nebula, and here the planets are screaming at us that there's more mass, a la the sort of Chang-Laughlin models, there's more mass in these disks, they're screaming at us about this, but we're clinging to the minimum mass solar nebula like a blanket in our thumb in our mouths, not willing to admit that, gee, you know, we have no observational constraint on the densities of the disks, and moreover, the exoplanets are telling us there probably was more material in the disks.
Wow. The minimum mass was never viewed, or was not generally viewed as the right number.
It is, after all, the minimum.
Right.
So.
Right.
I think the issue, I agree with that, but I think the issue is whether it's a factor of 2 away or a factor of 20 away.
Right.
Or something like
yes.
That.
Yes.
That's right.
And
there are plenty of observations, sub-millimeter observations of the outer parts of disks past, say, 10-20 AU, where they can, you know, where it's sometimes optically thin, they can measure things like the surface density profile and the mass. So from those masses, the typical mass is similar to the, you know, the total mass in a minimum mass type disk, something like, you know, 1% of the mass of the star.
Right.
Well, but, I mean, I think even with those, we don't know the exponent of the power law, assuming it is a power law. And if you take 1.5 from the solar system, but then you allow for the fact, well, Neptune migrate out these things, well, maybe it should be 2, right? And then once you change that extrapolation inwards, I mean, you could easily boost the inferred mass in your solar system quite a bit, or interplanetary systems quite a bit.
And also the solids estimates, they don't see big stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Right. They're limited to very small grains.
Yeah.
They can measure the surface density profiles, though. They tend to get r to the minus a half to r to the minus one. But again, there's no need for that
harder,
to really extrapolate.
And that's farther out. Yeah.
And that's more for.
Or gas.
It's measured usually in small dust grains. So
okay.
The gas estimates are usually.
And so if they all moved in, they would measure it.
But those are small enough, they should.
No.
Okay. Well, I mean,
there's indirect inference of pebbles too. That's.
Well, is there any effort to quantify the, like, the brightness scaling of these disks at different wavelengths corresponding to different particles? Say, maybe the profile for the gas is different from that, from the small dust grains, and that might still be different from that of larger dust grains. And I mean, how many different wavelengths of light do we have? Can we do this?
Well, these small dust grains are still anomalously large compared to interstellar dust. So presumably they grew in situ, but then if they grew substantially more in situ, if they grew another factor of 1,000, then we wouldn't be seeing them.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, but the usual way you find that is you use the argument that if they were old, they would be gone. So they must be being created by something larger. And that's how you find the real pebbles. You say that the pebbles and boulders are creating the dust we see today.
Oh, well, you're talking about remnant disks.
Right, yeah.
As opposed to, you're talking about stellar, you were talking about very young stars.
Yeah, I was talking about protoplanetary disks, the remnants.
But So is that the same argument for when they infer the pebble masses in these?
I forget the pebble thing. I always have to have someone explain that to me. So I can't say it.
Do you want to say anything about parking mechanisms at this juncture? You didn't, I'm stretching beyond.
Well, I think
talk,
another thing that's relevant,
I don't know how
is
park.
If you, giant planets tend to have preferred parking spots. The other thing that might be a clue is if you look at the distribution of locations of ungiant planets, you seem to see things that are for solar mass stars. You go down to around 10 days and the abundances seem roughly constant in dynamical space. So factors of 2 in period, which is how close you can pack them.
By abundances you mean the number of density of planets remains constant in log period intervals. Yeah.
Whereas if you go inside 10 days, then you don't see as many, though you do see them down to how many hours, Roberta?
So that's 4 here.
And the other thing, if you one say that, okay, it was too hot there, then you have to look, and you look at M dwarfs. And M dwarfs seem to have planets significantly closer. And you might say, okay, M dwarfs are significantly less luminous. But that's on the main sequence, not during the epoch of planet formation. They're less luminous, but they're not, it's not an M to the 4th or M to the 5th power the way it is in the 1/3 to 1 solar mass range of the main sequence.
Should we call it here?
I'm not advocating specific models, because Kepler's clues, Kepler is telling us things about planet formation, but in some sense, it doesn't fit in with our preconceived notions. And there are things that come out from our solar system, but we have most of our data on properties of planetary systems. It's from our own solar system, because we know so much more about what's going on here. And there are ideas that have been thrown out, but I don't find a lot of things that convincing.
Well, can you just name a few to educate us? What are people proposing to explain the Kepler cycle? That would be good.
Okay. You can have in situ formation, and the thing, this constant beyond in log period space beyond 10 days, and just a few inside, which presumably would have migrated, is an argument in favor of some in situ growth. I think it's the strongest argument.
Say it again.
The fact that you have roughly constant abundance in log period space above 10 days, but closer in, you have fewer planets. If you were just migrating, why would it be at a location which is near the rock sublimation point, do you have this reduction?
Wouldn't it correspond? I mean, it could be explained with an inner edge of the disk where migration should stop. So you have kind of a natural place to stop.
Okay, if you're migrating within the disk, but why is it necessarily at the
there isn't a pile
rock sublimation place?
Also, there's no pile up.
All right, but I mean, the migration model doesn't produce a pileup.
Well, no, if you stop
the inner guy. Well, so if you have a cohort of guys migrating inward, the inner edge basically stops the innermost, and then they.
But you'd have a lot of planets. If the inner edges were the same in most disks, then you'd have a lot of planets near 10 days.
Yeah,
and there's nothing special.
And you'd have mean motion resonances for this.
A point that I guess I didn't make strongly enough in my talk is that the migration model usually breaks the resonances at later stages. So while, you know, during the disk phase, you got things locked in resonance, but there's lots of things that can break those.
Yeah, but most of them keep them nearby at that point.
Well, the main mechanism we're finding is that you kind of break the resonant chain such that there's a phase of instability, which ends up shuffling things around, and we don't end up with things.
Once the systems go nuts, then you tend to get higher eccentricities and not as closely packed systems.
But this happens while the gas is still dissipating, so there's still a little bit of gas left.
Well, and then after the gas is gone, there's the planetesimals, which can power a whole new phase of migration and eccentricity damping.
You don't have a lot of planetesimals there because the dynamical timescales are so short.
Well, but if you're presuming you have planets there, then how can you not presume that there were planetesimals to go with?
Planetesimals will be consumed on a timescale short compared to the observed gas lifetimes because the dynamical timescales are so short.
I don't think so. Especially if you're going to argue that there's an interior plane anyway, it's a barrier where, if anything, you'll get planetesimals accumulating behind it as there's a barrier they can't reach. And you could argue to form a chain of things based on the first one that grows up.
In an outer planetesimal disk?
Well, I wouldn't call it outer because it's 0.1 AU, but exterior to the to whatever the first thing that grows up and creates a barrier is.
Yes, but the time you'd grow and create this barrier is very short compared to the lifetime of the disk.
Great. So you grow, you create something, and then you have plenty of time for the rest of the disk in the exterior regions to create planetesimals, move them in, and bring them
in. Drag them in, you're saying?
Sure.
And then, one of the mechanisms for forming the planets is you don't have this hugely massive disk there, but you're forming planetesimals farther out, and they're gas dragging in, and they're feeding planets. But the problem is they're feeding the outermost planet in the chain, that would tend to produce a migration of the outer planet inward and give you more resonance locks.
Well, so the thing that Surav and I looked at explicitly was if you had two giant planets that were in a 2-to-1 resonance and you embedded them in a planetesimal disk, and even when, if they started in resonance, you can break the resonance and leave them a few to 10% away pretty easily. So, I mean, you can argue whether or not the planetesimals would be there, but if they are there, it's easy to sort of break the exact resonances that you could imagine as being set up in the previous era.
So, these viable models that can form planets in situ?
If you have the solids there, yeah. I mean, getting the accreting the gas in situ?
I don't know, from the beginning. I mean, it starts.
From solid bodies, if you have the solids in there close in, they're going to accrete. Because this is way beyond the tidal Roche limit equivalent of the sun and of the star. But close enough that the dynamical times for accretion are very short.
And so are the in-spiral times.
But the dynamical times I'm talking about, based on the mass of the planetesimal disk, the in-spiral times are based on the gas.
So the basic problem I see is you have some planets that are rocky and some are gaseous at basically the same place, and you're trying to explain the two things with one theory. So something was different, right? And so if you just say how are you going to explain the rocky things and I don't need any gas, you can make up one set of stories. But if you then say, oh, now I want to explain planets that have a lot of gas in them, well now the easiest scenarios to construct are different.
Okay. Well, one of the reasons, this is a three-dimensional plot with color. This is why I like this design, this color plot with Eric. And if you look down here, the mostly rocky things are the hot things.
Oh, but that's all selection effect.
Yeah, well, what do you mean selection effect?
Well, you couldn't find anything. The smallest planets, the only way you would have found them is if they were hot.
But they're the smallest planet for a given mass.
When you say mass, you confuse me frequently. I think you mean density more often than not.
Density, these are constant contours. I use mass and radius. I don't like to think in terms of density because for a given composition, the density depends hugely on the size, the radius. You put, for these planets which are mostly rock or ice, and they're not more than that much more massive than Earth, then density is meaningful. But if they're gas-rich planets, density is really tricky. And thinking of something as a density 3, what does that mean in terms of gas? Well, if it's more massive, if you look at these gas, constant percentages of gas, you go from the constant percentages of gas are more proportional to the size of the planets than the density.
Sure. Most of the dots on the diagram are well below that point. And that's actually associated with the behavior of the hydrogen and helium molecules.
Most of the dots are below this point, but they're below that curve. But if we had the 1 or 2% hydrogen, they'd be around here. And they'd be pretty flat too.
So you think that is actually also controlling most of the 1% hydrogen bodies?
I think there are 1% hydrogen bodies. I think it's simpler to have a distribution in which you have 1% hydrogen bodies, then that bodies like this are H2O.
Yeah.
If they are H2O, then you have another variable, and you can play around a lot more. It's even more difficult to understand. But I think I am not driven to that. The water world is a very attractive concept, but I don't see evidence for that.
So is that a bias or not? It sounds like a bias to me. I mean, it's sort of like, why can't you equally entertain it?
I am saying there's no reason you need that complexity. I don't see any evidence for it.
The data doesn't require it. On
right.
the other hand,
we've got a solar system.
I'm inclined to think also that anything that's possible will be there if you right. get enough data.
Yeah.
So there'll probably be the super Ganymedes as well.
But that
doesn't. But there's nothing in this diagram that says it has to be a super Ganymede.
Or that it's likely to be that there's likely to be a population of them. It doesn't mean that there aren't any, but I'm not driven to. This is my interpretation of the data. That there's nothing driving me to that.
Yeah. In fact, the plot that Becky showed us before she left, showing the population of planets very, very close to their stars. And their size distribution showed that that plot showed that there were no planets except for 55 Cancri E of size 2 times the radius of Earth within an orbital period of 1 day.
Well, wait, 1.7 Earth radii.
For 55 Cancri E?
You said 2 Earth radii, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I just said that there aren't any that are 2.
Compared to it's 1.7, right? It depends on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are none between. Right. There are no planets between the size 1.7 Earth radii, which we think is close to the threshold of how big rocky planets can be, and 2 Earth radii. There are no planets in that size range within an orbital period of 1 day. Now, if there were a lot of planets that had a rocky core and then a steamy envelope, we would see many more such planets. We would see planets between sizes of 1.7 and 2 Earth radii within an orbital period of 1 day. Because whatever migration mechanism has brought in the planets smaller than 1.7 Earth radii shouldn't care whether those planets are pure rock or have a steamy envelope, if there really is some migration mechanism creating these ultra short period planets. So the absence of planets between 1.7 and 2 Earth radii in short periods is showing us that we don't have, or that these steam worlds are not common. Because if they were common, they would have showed up there.
You have to walk me that through that more slowly if you want me to believe it. It's sufficiently complicated that I don't get it.
All right. Jack Lissauer said, ungiant planets are really common, by which he means especially planets that are between 2 and 4 times the radius of Earth are especially common. They're even more common than planets of, say, 1 to 1.5 times the size of the Earth. Which we
no, I don't say that.
Yeah, don't.
You might not say that. I'll say that.
Well, I don't want to hear the rest of the argument if that's your premise.
You don't want to hear it?
Well, I mean, if the argument depends upon that assumption, then yeah, it's not.
But well, that is a result determined by Fresen et al. 2013, both of the Pettigura et al. 2013 papers.
Yeah.
Well, that there's
we can talk
a flat distribution, or even declining, maybe slightly at small radii, for planets between 1 and 4 Earth radii in orbital periods of 5 to 100 days. when we refocus our attention toward the innermost planets, planets in periods of less than one day, we don't see that same size distribution. We see a totally different size distribution. We only see planets that are smaller than 1.7 Earth radii. We don't see any of the 2 to 4 Earth radius planets in orbital periods of less than one day.
So my interpretation of that would be that the characterization of the distribution of sizes at larger periods is not very good, and that's why there's a difference there.
Or hydrogen evaporation.
But
I don't even know what you're talking about, Eric.
So she's claiming that there's a difference in the radius distribution at the smallest orbital periods and larger orbital periods.
Were you at Becky's talk?
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't understand why you're...
Okay, let me give you my take on it.
Just the short period.
Yeah.
Where are the medium-sized planets?
Yeah.
But that's an entirely different question, whether nature forms them.
No, but they are... You can find all sizes farther out. It's just that close in.
I believe that there aren't larger ones close in. That's not obvious.
Okay.
But the question... What's happening at the smallest sizes is where it's less clear.
There could be small, rocky ones further out, too. But
right.
That's besides the point. Why closer in don't we find bigger ones? I mean, that's not a solution.
Well,
they're Roche limits.
They evaporate.
Constraints.
The big ones will have gases, and they will just evaporate. Right?
That's the point.
But
that's
if you had icy planets, you could have more 55 Cancri E type planets in there that have masses that are not rocky. I mean, if you just had 55 Cancri E and it happened to be rocky because there was one very unusual, you know, you merge two 1.7 Earth radii planets.
There is one such planet on Kepler, right? I can't remember which one.
Yeah, it depends on if you're taking one sigma lower bounds. I don't think there is any.
I don't understand what's happened in this conversation. It's as if.
Whether there are water worlds.
Yeah.
It's what evidence do we have statistically? And yes, 55 Cancri E is anomalous.
Okay, good. So let's not talk about it, please. Thank you.
Well, but so I hear two things. I hear you saying there's no evidence that there is a large population of water worlds. But then over here, I hear there's evidence that water worlds don't exist. And those are...
No, but they're rare. They're
rare. Rare. Okay, but fine. But those are two very different statements. One is there's not a large population of them. The other is they're rare. And I believe the argument that they're not a large population. I don't follow the argument for why they need to be rare.
Okay, no, let's just say we agree. So, summary, whatever qualifying word you use, at least for me, I don't know what Lori. But they're not the rule.
An absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So Jack's saying there's no evidence for a large population.
No, there is an evidence of absence because Kepler is complete at orbital periods below one day. Kepler didn't accidentally miss the water worlds there. It would have found them if they were there.
But
the Kepler pipeline missed them, but we're
doing it. I should say
I'm trying to point to Eric, because if you see the error bars, the absolute value of the occurrence rate of planets from 1 to 1.4 radius or whatever, it's only 4 times larger than the uncertainty. So I'm sure that if you do the specific numbers and statistics, the upper bound might come out to be 20-25% of water worlds. That could be an upper bound. Is that rare? I don't think that qualifies as rare. It's just that it's not half of the population, but I don't know if you can say they are really rare. The statistics are not so strong at the shortest period.
I'm really, really surprised at this conversation. I'm really, really shocked. So I can't help but try to redo what Becky did. Somebody's going to have to tell me what is wrong with this. Roberto has a distribution of planet radii for planets inward of one day. And that distribution, I don't know if this thing is in the way for, well, Roberto, you don't need to see it because you're And that thing looks like something like this. And there's, I'm not sure I can do justice to it, it looks something like that. And there's maybe somewhere. That's what it looks like.
And that's
well, I think it's cheaper than that.
And that's only 3 points with large error bars, but yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah. Please.
How many points do you have in general? How many planets do you have?
100. Like 70 or something. Yeah.
70, right?
So very so, is this based on the
This is the number of planets.
So those, okay. Thank
you. And is that a linear or log scale?
This is for P less than 1 day.
And is the y-axis linear or
log? Doesn't matter.
Well,
the whole point is we cut off at 1.7.
And this is corrected for a full detection limit? For detection
when you
bar?
Correct for the detection limit, it looks like that, yeah. But
only when you correct this?
Only when you correct for detection, of course, yeah. Because I'm using all 100,000 stars, so in some cases you will miss them. So there's a correction that involves pipeline efficiency and detectability, depending on the star.
And the correction inserts some error.
Yeah. It's like I try to quantify
it
by.
What does the correction have to do with this?
No, it has to do.
Why? There's a cutoff at 1.7. What correction is needed to zero?
No, but is this because of the instrument or is this actually exists?
So that's the point.
Yeah.
Planets, and Lauren made it very clearly, planets larger than 1.7 Earth radii would stand out even more if they were there, but they're not. And this was a great discovery that Roberto made single-handedly with the Kepler data. So, you know, whatever scale you want to use, log, because the absence of these planets, and as Lauren pointed out, especially right in here, that absence. And then the point Becky made, which was dramatic, was she said, okay, what about planets with periods more than 1 day? And you know, as I think a lot of us have mentioned, the completeness is only good out to maybe 20 or 30 or 40 or maybe up to 100 days or whatever. But there, when you plot the number of planets as a function of their size, it looks something more like this, where this is the famous Pedagora Plateau, right in here.
What?
And the shape of this isn't important. What is important is that this cutoff, as Becky very beautifully, I thought, pointed out, this cutoff at something like 1.6 or 1.7 that Roberto found is not here. So there are planets, and I'm trying to do justice to Lauren's, I thought, articulate way of saying it. These planets in particular, as Becky pointed out, are quite interesting. And maybe you go a little farther if you want to. Because she said that you have to understand why it is that at something like 1 day, you don't see planets here that you would have seen. So why aren't there planets here? And the argument she put forward without proof, as she was, I think, careful to say, is one interpretation is that these planets that we do see here have some small amount of gas, hydrogen and helium gas. It's only a couple percent. But that gas, plausibly, when you draw the planet inward of a day or so, that gas gets UV and X-ray, blown away from the planet by one process or another. And so, at least a plausible argument is that, you know, that there we would have seen we definitely would have seen planets here. But an argument is we don't see them because they've lost their gas. Now, with regard to water worlds, I think Becky was also pretty clear because she invoked Eric Lopez's theory with Jonathan Fortney and others who've done similar calculations to say that when you draw planets in this close, my understanding is that you can demonstrate that there's enough energy, and Ruth was also alluding to this, there's plenty of energy to strip away the gas, but there isn't from the star. But there isn't enough energy in the form of UVs and X-rays to get rid of the water. Leslie, is that about? And so then it's plausible that these guys have our water worlds, but have lost their gas. And so they're small.
I don't necessarily trust the energy limited escape calculations that have been applied to date to water envelopes. So today they're assuming the same energy limited efficiency factor as kind of Ruth.
But the point that Ruth made was that if anything, those models are too optimistic in how much water you can run away.
In some cases, once you get inward closer to one day, some, not all those planets, but some subset of them were close enough where Rochelle overflow could have sculpted. And there, you're no longer talking about evaporation from the star,
but
rather, like, just if you're a low enough density, be that due to hydrogen, helium, or a steam envelope, materials going to flow from the planet onto the star or through the outer Lagrange point. So. Mm-hmm. I think when you're talking about planets interior to one day, it's not just evaporation that you need to worry about anymore.
Okay. So then what is the modification to what Becky said? In her case, she was saying it's plausible that it's just the gas that went away, giving you this truncation in the radius distribution. What you're saying is
I
you might also be using the water as well, which would still give you a truncation radius. It's just that now they're stripped of their water too.
Yeah, so I think could easily modify the arguments just by looking at, okay, assuming you had a water world, what would kind of the ratio of the size, or how would the planet radii relate to their Roche radii for different densities, assuming a rocky body, a water world, or a
planet? Doesn't matter. Roche radius is going to be dependent on the density. Overall density of the planet. So if you have a mass radius relationship at a location, it won't matter what's at the
top. The mass of a planet depends on whether, for a given radius, because all we've measured with Kepler is the radii, the mass that you assign to that radius depends on the composition.
Oh, the mass you assign to the radius, but if you take this plot, it doesn't matter whether it's 99% rock and 1% hydrogen, or 50% rock and 50% water, if it has the same mass and same radius, the Roche overflow is going to be identical.
Look, I have a question. I have a question. What is 55 Cancri-E's Roche radius?
So I think 55 Cancri-E is filling 30 to 40% of its Roche load.
And it's something like almost 7 grams per cubic centimeter, I think.
So there, I think that there are some Kepler planets, we can even see them on that diagram, that have similar masses and radii, to 55 Cancri-E, and pretty similar orbital periods. So so then if they too had water,
I mean, I'm not saying that the whole argument falls apart, I'm just saying that as currently presented, it needs to be amended a bit. And I think it is true that for an instantaneous planet mass and radius, that, right, the Roche limit only depends on the mean density, but the behavior as you remove mass from the planet will depend on whether that's a hydrogen helium envelope or if it's a water envelope, kind of the how the mass, the radius of the planet behaves as you remove mass from it depends on that. And so I think we should think about that and work that out.
Yeah, but you're only removing the mass.
And we're already
is there a profile for the planets with hydrogen helium envelope?
Well,
you could
for a Jupiter-sized planet, I think it's complicated by several factors. Because if you're close, well,
it only depends on the profile.
It also depends to the extent that the material from the planet is able to form some sort of accretion disk around the star, and how much does that angular momentum feedback onto the planet. I mean, in stellar binary evolution calculations, like when you have mass flowing from a lower mass secondary onto a higher mass primary, if you can have the coupling of the angular momentum so it feeds back onto the orbit, then that body will move further out and the mass loss will be reduced.
Right.
If you're in this close, I don't know I think people are working on this, and Francesca would be a good person to ask about this, but I'm it's not clear to me that if you're inward of a one-day orbit, the little, if there is some sort of tenuous accretion disk formed from the material flowing off these planets, whether that would be able to feed back the angular momentum to push the planet further out.
The anomalous thing about 55 Cancri E is that it's a red point. It's very substantially illuminated, and it's off this rock line.
We also have kick spectra for all these stars now, and we've made the new plot with the planetary radius for all the planets with low Doppler shorter than one day. And my impression is that 55 Cancri doesn't look like an outlier. That I mean, it looks like the largest planet, but it doesn't look so much of an outlier. And since we are here for the workshop, if anybody wants to look at that, it's not published yet, so maybe we can sit down and look at the new. Did we made it put any plots for that? I made a plot, but I don't know if I updated it with your stellar radius. But
Ellen has just been rerunning the stellar radii.
So maybe by next week we will have updated planetary radius for all these objects, shorter period than one day, and then we can take a look and see how many of them are like 55 Cancri E, how many of them are larger. At least hopefully it's not.
Have the temperature of the star for it? Can you estimate the temperature of the surface of the planet?
Assuming a certain albedo. Yes.
Yeah, that's why I use flux, because you—that's the actual observable.
And we had such a plot for like let's say less than 1 week.
We can take it.
I knew that it was
off. Do you want your computer back?
Yes, I think that puts a good endpoint. Thank you so much, Jack.